those few verses at the beginning to try and put the whole thing, passage, into context. And for those who came to the home group in November, when we looked at the Gospel of Mark, you will of course remember that chapter 8 is the turning point, the midpoint of Mark's Gospel, of him showing who Jesus is and what his ministry is. If you don't remember that, go home and read your notes. And if you weren't there, we can, no doubt we can find you some. And it's that bit, the first part of Mark's Gospel, it's very much about the ministry of Jesus. And the second part is very much about his mission, what he was called to do. But it had to be in steps, because, like most of us, the disciples couldn't take everything on board in one go. They had to initially discover who Jesus was, who they thought he was. And so we have that amazing decoration. Jesus is very gentle in some ways, isn't he? When he goes for a punch. He said to his disciples, very easy question, who do the people say that I am? And I'm sure we could all answer that one. So who do the people say that Jesus is? And so they said, John the Baptist, Elijah, one of the prophets. But then that punch question that so often he uses when he's talking with people, he makes them think. He expects them to grapple with what they've heard, what they've seen, to come to terms with who he is. And he asked his disciples, what about you? Who do you say that I am? And I think that that is one of the key questions we have to grapple with during the Lenten season and as we go into Good Friday, Holy Week and Good Friday, and on to Easter Sunday. Who, Jesus asked each one of us, who do you say that I am? And we can sit here and switch off. We can say, oh, Jesus is Son of God, Jesus is Messiah. But what does that actually mean to you? And that's a challenge for me, and a challenge for you. Because although I know that Jesus is my Saviour, he's Messiah, I understand why he came and why he went through that journey, through the cross and resurrection. But my understanding is only partial. And as I explore more, and think more, and trust more, and believe more, I come to a slightly deeper and newer understanding, a deeper and newer relationship with Jesus. It's a bit like, isn't it, sort of, I was having a conversation when I had my hair cut the other day. A person who cuts my hair, we were chatting, and we got around to sat-navs, OS maps, don't ask me how, but we both said we loved OS maps and we'd always use them if we could. Because if you're driving, he's a motorcyclist, it's about seeing where you're going, what you're going into, what the line of the land is, and all the things that you don't see on the sat map. Yes, there's a weekly lie down around the sat-nav, but it doesn't actually tell you there's a deep ford at the end of it. Or there's no way, it's going to get so narrow, there's no way you can get through so you can have back all the way back. And it's that bit of not seeing the whole picture. And then I was reflecting that actually, we are growing to be, or helping, a society and a group of people that likes things in bite-sized pieces. I mean, if you watch BBC, every so often they advertise their bite-sized learning, don't they? And I was only thinking about, talking about maps, I was only thinking about the very first road atlas I bought in comparison with the road atlas I've got now. The very first one was clearly laid out. It showed me where the hills were, where the rivers were, unable to show me where churches were. But then, gradually things like churches disappeared, and we suddenly had leisure centres, places of interest, where to get your own next cup of tea. And there's so many more roads now, and I find it sometimes quite complex to look at a road atlas and work out where do I want to be, which is where Satman comes in. So we need all these bits. We need to see the big picture, we need to see the smaller picture, to understand really who Jesus is, why he came, and what his mission and ministry is. But Peter really must have felt that he'd been kicked in the teeth by Jesus. Because he had answered, "Jesus, you are the Messiah." And he tells him not to tell anybody about it, because the time wasn't right. And also, it would be, once he started, he acknowledged that, and the disciples acknowledged it, the people, the authorities who were against him, and the Romans, would find far more excuses to do away with him. And so he began moving on from ministry to mission, to explain to them why the Son of Man had to suffer and be rejected by elders, chief priests, teachers of the law, and why he must be killed after 3 days. He was open about it. But the disciples could not get their heads around it. I'm not sure if I could, if I had been following somebody who I believed was God's Son, who I believed was the Messiah. Somebody who was unique, somebody who was special, who I believed was the Messiah come to save Israel. I would have thought immediately, well, actually, this is a bit stupid, isn't it? The person who's come to redeem Israel is now just going to go get himself killed. It's completely illogical, isn't it? But Israel might have been brave. And so when Peter said to him, and what I do like here about Peter, he didn't say it in a large group of disciples, even if they were all thinking it. He took Jesus to one side and said, "You can't do this. There's no way you can get killed." But Jesus rebuked Peter with speaking to all the disciples. And it's a really interesting sentence. "You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns." And we, on the whole, can only think in human terms. But we have to begin to see things from God's perspective. And a person called Michel Voss, many years ago, wrote a book of prayers. they're amazing, a lot of reflections. And it's got one that begins, "I would like to rise very high. I would like to rise very high, Lord, above my city, above the world, above time. I would like to purify my glance and borrow your eyes. I would then see the universe, humanity, history, as a father sees them. I would see a prodigious transformation of matter in a perpetual seeding of life. Your great body, which is born of the breath of the Spirit. I would see the beautiful, the eternal thought of the Father's love taking form step by step. Everything summed up in you, things on earth and things in heaven. And I would see that today, like yesterday, the most minute details are part of it. Every person in their place, every group, and every object." I would begin to understand that great adventure of love, which started at the beginning of the world, is unfolding before me. And that is part of our Lent, isn't it? That's divine story, according to God's promise, beginning at the beginning of creation, and being completed later on. I would understand everything, that everything is linked together. Then falling on my knees, I would mark, Lord, the mystery of this world, which in spite of the innumerable and hateful snacks of sin, is a long frog of love, God's love eternal. I would like to rise very high, above my city, above the world, above time. I would like to purify my glance and borrow your eyes. And as we look at this passage, we need to borrow the eyes of God, His Spirit, to illuminate us. Excuse me. And here's only water. It hasn't become wine yet. And he then goes on and he calls the crowds over there, telling them the cost of following him, that they have to be prepared to put Jesus first. And actually, it's not about what suits them as a person. Is ensuring that Christ's love is flowing through us. This is where you want to do part two, really. Because what I found again really interesting in this one passage, it happened in a place called Caesarea Philippi, right north of the Sea of Galilee. And in that city, in that area, was a fairly new temple to, if you like, the god of the world. In fact, to Caesar Augustus, the emperor of Rome, who was the person that people expected to worship. And so we have this amazing challenge. Before, in unknown territory, first of all, and with this temple to this Caesar Augustus, they were asked that question, who do you say that I am? And what does that mean? And it means that we have to see the bigger picture. It means that we have to take the steps of faith. We have to trust. And we have to believe the impossible. It's so easy for us to get wrapped up in the little things, even in church, even in our own life. But we need to see bigger. And it's remembering a hymn that was written some time ago, which says, "Oh Lord, all the world belongs to you, and you are always making all things new. What is wrong, you forgive, and the new life you give is what turning the world upside down." And Jesus was turning the upside world upside down. And I think I'm just going to have an end here and let you ponder out the rest.